The Cut Print Film Podcast is brought to you by Audible. You could get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/cutprintfilm.
Welcome all ye to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode number 61. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Coming to you live from across an ocean of digital digibytes and giggly gigabytes, it's the Cut Print Film Podcast.
Wow, what an opening.
Episode 61.
Yes.
Oh, good. I didn't fuck that up. I'm your host, Davey Costell.
I'm Jeff Rollins.
I'm Chris Evangelista.
I said the F word right there in the beginning.
And when our powers combine, we are Cut Print Film, a podcast about film.
Yes, and movies.
Yeah, it's right there in the name.
Kodak film.
You can get all of our shenanigans, our reviews, our editorials, our interviews, our news, all that stuff on cutprintfilm.com.
And if you would be so kind, dearest listener, why not give us a 5-star review on iTunes and say, hey, you guys are really good. I love your dulcet tones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that all sounds great.
Yeah, all of it. All of it in theory sounds wonderful.
What sounds even better is be our friend on Facebook, like our page.
Yeah.
And follow us on Twitter, because we're constantly sending out tweets into the stratosphere.
Yeah.
No one's reading them, but we're sending them out, and hopefully one day we'll hear back.
If you're already our Facebook friend and you read something, like it.
Or
that
share
helps us
it.
Out.
Yeah, because Facebook sucks, so...
Yeah. Well, the fun's over.
Yes.
And
down to business.
Let's get down to the box office this weekend,
right,
where Jurassic World came out and blew away everybody's expectations, financially at least.
Yes.
It is now the second biggest opening in history.
Wow, what's the first?
Little Man, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
That makes sense.
What is the first? Titanic?
Mm-mm.
E.T.?
No. Nope. We'll just say titles and eventually you'll get it right.
Avengers?
No.
Yeah, no, it's
Harry Potter 7.
It's Little Man 2.
It's Little Man 10.
No, Jurassic World has made $204.6 million.
That's how much I made last year, personally.
Did you claim any of that?
No.
You're in trouble.
Don't tell Uncle Sam.
You're in big trouble with my Uncle Sam.
3 days.
That's it made more in its opening weekend than people predicted it would make its entire run.
Do you know what this means?
No.
There's
going
to be a whole lot more Jurassic Park movies coming.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, and all right, so let's talk about Jurassic World, because,
yes,
you know, as far as moviegoers are concerned, they loved it.
Yeah, I mean, the general public, I would say, had a hoot with this film.
Yes, they had
Jurassic World, Party Time, excellent.
Yeah. Wow.
Yes, they all did 1992 SNL references.
Yes.
When they walked out of the theater.
And they did Stuart Saves His Family references. And The Ladies' Man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as far as the general public is concerned, this is a great movie. Yeah. Everybody seems to be saying great, nice things about it.
How's Lieutenant Public taking this?
Not as good as Colonel Public.
Yeah,
are we done?
Admiral Public.
Now we're done.
Okay.
But as far as critics go,
yes,
they're kind of cold. They're kind of lukewarm on this movie.
It's a mixed bag. On cutprintfilm.com, I gave this a 6 out of 10, which is a fairly positive rating, I would say. But there are critics out there who are calling this film terrible, which...
I disagree with that sentiment.
Yes.
This is not a terrible film.
No.
I really enjoyed it. It has problems, which we'll get to.
Right.
But it also has great things that I like, which we'll also get to.
Yeah.
And the stuff that I liked far outweighs the stuff I hated.
I mean, yeah, first and foremost, I would say this is it's a fun movie.
Yeah.
It's fast-paced. There's no lull in it. I mean, one of the hugest problems with The Lost World is there are stretches in that movie where it's insanely dull, and for a movie directed by Spielberg and also a movie that's a sequel to Jurassic Park, that's sort of inexcusable.
The Lost World was the first Spielberg disappointment I ever encountered as a kid. Because of that, those character moments that you're used to with Spielberg that are always so heartwarming,
mm-hmm.
He's trying for them, but they don't exist in that movie.
And then you have the little girl who kicks a raptor with gymnastics to death.
That stunk, too. I've never liked that.
No.
So you're saying that it's tonally different than the other
Jurassic Park movies? Like,
well,
it's
all three Jurassic Park movies are completely different from one another already.
I would say the way to look at this is not as a Jurassic Park sequel, but as a film that exists in the Jurassic Park cinematic universe. That's what it feels like to me. It doesn't really feel like a sequel. It just feels like it's set in the same world where, you know, dinosaurs have been brought back to life.
Yeah.
Yo, the people who made this movie love that you just said that, because they're like, yeah, we're making a whole cinematic universe.
Well, they just put a bunch of money in my bank account, so.
But yeah, you definitely get the feeling, especially after this this box office success for the opening weekend, that we are in store for, like you said, an entire cinematic universe.
Right.
And I think the direction, well, I can't imagine they ever open the park again after what happens in this
film.
Yeah,
that would be a PR nightmare, but you never know.
So you have to, the logical assumption is that they either take it the way of, you know, militarizing these dinosaurs, which I really hope that doesn't happen.
Ugh.
Or you go the other way where, with the Lost World kind of hinted on, where the dinosaurs either attack mainland, or they take over a section of mainland,
right.
Or maybe they take over the island and,
or the White House.
I
mean,
well, you took it a step further than I was thinking.
I saw someone on Twitter, they jokingly were saying, like, what they should do is they should turn this into like the Planet of the Apes franchise, where the dinosaurs slowly just take over the world. And even though it's a joke, I kind of think that's actually a sort of like great idea to do something with that, because it's different. I mean, there's not a lot left you can do with this. Like, I feel like, even though I enjoyed this movie, I feel like you really shouldn't have any more sequels to this. I don't feel like Jurassic Park feels like a franchise. It shouldn't feel like a franchise.
I could see something cool like The Walking Dead, but with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
instead of Planet of the Apes, because the Planet of the Apes, the apes are intelligent and they take over.
Well, these are genetically modified dinosaurs in this, so in a sense, they're intelligent. By the way, as we talk about this, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
We'll be talking some somewhat mild spoilers.
Should we give just like a general overview of what this film is about? Because Dave hasn't even seen it yet.
Yeah,
so.
Dave's our Jurassic World virgin.
Yes.
And we'll be gentle.
So yeah, this film, it's set, you know, 20-some years after the first film. I feel like this is sort of a... It ignores part 2 and 3. It sort of acts like, it doesn't say they didn't happen, but it sort of acts like they did. It's kind of like how Halloween H2O acted like everything after Halloween 2 didn't exist.
Yeah. Does it matter if those movies happened, though?
Not really, no.
I guess because they attacked mainland.
Yeah,
so
that's
an issue.
They never reference that incident
okay.
at all, whereas the third one references the...
Well, maybe it's
San
like...
Diego, they call it the San
yeah,
Diego,
the San Diego
incident. It's probably like Walt Disney's anti-Semitism. Nobody mentioned
they,
it.
Yeah, they sweep it under the rug. So yeah, it's set some 20 years after Bryce Dallas Howard. She's sort of like, she's like the John Hammond in this film, where she runs the park. She's sort of like the manager of the park, and her two nephews are coming to visit for the weekend, which is a really lazy plot point. I felt like, because why are her nephews just coming to this park?
Who knows?
But so.
Wait, those kids are her nephews?
Yeah.
That feels weak.
And so, Bryce Dallas Howard she plays a robot woman in this film. And she just can't do anything right, including her job.
Yeah. I mean, I like Bryce Dallas Howard. I think she's a good actress. I think she's okay in this movie. I think the problem is the character is poorly...
That's the problem with every character.
Yeah, every character in this movie is terribly written. This film is not a character movie. And so the film has a sort of like a meta sort of comment on itself. Basically... At the start of the film, they acknowledge that, like, oh, no one's excited by dinosaurs anymore. Dinosaurs have become sort of, like, common in the universe this film exists, because everyone is used to them again. So to get things more exciting, the park engineers, including Dr. Wu from the first movie, played by B.D. Wong.
Which I loved. I love seeing him.
Yeah. They've sort of...
spiced things up a little bit.
A little cardamom.
This
is good.
They've engineered brand new dinosaurs who've never even existed, and it's the Indominus Rex who's sort of... And from there, the film sort of it becomes a slasher movie with a dinosaur. Basically, the Indominus Rex gets out of his pen, or her pen, sorry.
He creeps around.
Yeah, she creeps around just stalking people and murdering people, and... So Chris Pratt's in it. He plays a guy named Owen. He's a raptor trainer. He trains the raptors.
And just so you know, I've seen this movie, and so has Chris, and we have no idea why this character even works at Jurassic Park.
Yeah, it's
I don't know what his point is.
He has a skill set. He got the job.
That's a different movie. That's a different franchise.
So the rest of the movie, it's just Bryce Dallas Howard and Chris Pratt's character trying to stop the Indominus Rex from killing everyone. And also there's a really terrible subplot involving Vincent D'Onofrio's character, who another character, I don't know why he's in this movie.
Well, Vincent D'Onofrio plays Yosemite Sam. And he's a military contractor,
I guess. Yeah, I guess he works for InGen, which, first of all, how is InGen still in business after?
Oh, they would be bankrupt yes. after the first film.
Yeah, but he works.
They would have at least changed their name. Like,
yeah, but no, he flat out, he's like, I work for InGen, and he wants Chris Pratt's Raptors to just fucking flat out be soldiers. He's like, drones can't explore caves. We want Raptors to explore caves for the military.
That sounds logical.
It's really dumb and has no business being in the movie.
Yeah, they act as though Raptors couldn't be gunned down.
Yeah.
It's the strangest leap of judgment I've seen.
Basically, Vincent D'Onofrio's character treats Raptors as if they were RoboCop in this movie. Like he works for Omnicorp in RoboCop. And
what's his name in Aliens?
Paul Reiser? Yeah, sort of.
Kind of like that?
There's a lot of aliens in this.
Yeah, okay. There's a lot of...
Oh, maybe I will enjoy this
movie. It's a fun movie. So, I mean, what do we want to... We want to talk about what we enjoyed and then what we didn't enjoy?
Yeah, let's do what we enjoy first, because I feel like a lot of people aren't... A lot of critics aren't talking about what they enjoyed.
Right.
And what I liked about this movie a lot is that it's first and foremost about the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. They take center stage. Whereas in the first Jurassic Park, and I'll say that this is what made that one so good, is yes, you had the great effects of the dinosaurs you were seeing for the first time ever on screen, but the characters in that first movie are really, they're layered, and they're interesting. And like Dr. Ian Malcolm has interesting things to say about chaos theory.
Every character in the first Jurassic Park, they're all at least just a little interesting. Even the lawyer who gets eaten on a toilet, you know.
Yeah,
everything you need to know about him, you know. Whereas in this film, it's not.
There's something genius about the first Jurassic Park too, where none of the character types are typical characters in the movie.
Yes.
Like there's no main
in 1993, there was no teen girl hackers in movies, and we get that. We get a teenage girl who happens to know Unix.
Yeah. Right.
So I mean. Even though that's not exactly accurate as to how...
But even, like, your leading man being Sam Neill.
Yeah, like Sam Neill.
Yeah, 45-year-old man.
A stuffy paleontologist is your lead character.
Okay, so back to what I like about this movie. The dinosaurs take center stage, and the effects, the special effects are incredible.
Yeah. A lot of people said, like, when the trailer came out, they thought those effects looked bad.
I said that, actually.
They did in the trailer, but they completely fixed that for the... Okay. I mean, you can tell it's CGI, obviously, but it looks good. There was never a moment where I was like, oh, this looks fake.
And there's a lot of CGI on CGI elements where it's nothing but CGI. And a lot of times that bugs me, but in this I didn't have a problem with it. It was sort of like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, when the apes are only interacting with one another.
Right.
I bought it, and I buy this. So and it looks nice.
So it doesn't have like the Hobbit effect where it starts to feel like you're watching a cartoon.
No,
nope. There's nothing cartoony about this at all, I would say. I also like the fact that, like you said, they sort of make meta commentary on the fact that nobody wants to see dinosaurs. You have to do something different. And they kind of wink. Maybe they wink a little too hard, and it's constant winking about the fact that, you know... They make reference to Verizon Wireless promoting Verizon Wireless presents Indominus Rex. Like, that's a joke. Well, they're actually talking to Verizon Wireless executives when they say it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And I really like that stuff, because I feel like if there were a real Jurassic Park, that's exactly what would happen.
Yeah.
Like, what I love about – I love the way the park looks in this movie, because it looks – it looks crowded, and it looks not shitty, but it looks unfun. And that's what a real Jurassic Park would end up being. It would just be this crowded nightmare, basically like Disney World. You're just waiting in line for hours.
Yeah, I'll say that's the other thing I like. The park itself looks and feels like a real place.
Right.
They have tours of the omnivore, not the herbivores, that you can do like a safari of the herbivores, where you're in that sphere that you see in the trailer.
And there's like a petting zoo for the baby dinosaur.
Yeah,
which
you,
I really,
you can ride like baby Triceratops like a pony.
Yeah.
Can we go?
Yeah.
There's also, they do 3D holograms of, there's a great one of the Dilophosaurus.
Yeah.
The hologram pops up and it's the Dilophosaurus like spitting its venom and it distracts a raptor in this film because the raptor thinks it's real. So it goes to attack it. So there's neat things like that that allude to the first
film. Does Newman pop up as a hologram?
Yeah. He finally goes, with the spit in his face.
No, but there is a great scene where they the two kids, they go off the safari on their own in that sphere, and they get attacked, and they eventually make their way to a building that it's essentially the...
It's the visitor center first movie.
Visitor center from the first film, and it's all overgrown. And it's really neat. You can see...
Yeah, like, they make a torch out of that sign that said, when dinosaurs ruled the earth, that fell at the end of the movie. Like, they wrap that around it.
It's really cool.
Did that give you goosebumps?
Yeah, a little
bit.
Yes,
it did. And I don't know that that's going to play well with kids that don't have the connection with the first one. Mm-hmm. But for the parents of those kids, because this is coming 23 years later from the first film, the parents of those kids, like us, will enjoy that. So that's... I think that's everything I enjoyed. It was action packed.
Yeah,
the action was incredible.
It never slows down. It's fun. I mean, to jump back to like the meta elements, like I really liked how the Indominus Rex. It's the Indominus Rex represents the movie itself, mm-hmm. whereas the film, like how do you say his name again, Jeff?
Colin Trevorrow.
He realized that anything he did, it would never live up to what Spielberg did, just because you can't, you know, they're not the same thing.
He's not trying to remake Jurassic Park.
Right. So basically, in a sense, his dinosaur represents the movie itself. It's basically this mutated monster that backfires, and no matter what he does, it's people are going to not like it.
And I'll say that Indominus Rex is incredible looking. It's terrifying, and...
Unlike like the Spinosaurus in Part 3, which I thought was just lame.
That was dumb. And I like Jurassic Park 3 because it's just so silly.
You're
but
right.
That Spinosaurus is lame.
Yes.
This is not lame. It's scary.
It's
a true villain. And you buy it. That this is a villain.
Like I said, it's like Jason Voorhees in dinosaur form. He's always just stalking around in the woods and he's just jumping out. And I won't say it's scary, but there are moments in this movie that just in general they're thrilling. They make you jump in your seat. I don't know.
Yeah, that's exactly. You jump in your seat. You grip the armrests,
and it's just fun. It's like a roller coaster in film form.
That's really okay. That's a good way to put it because it's a theme park in film form.
Yeah, and I mean, even like the sillier elements. Like one of the things that a lot of people hated in the trailers was the implication that Chris Pratt's character is training raptors. But I gotta say, I thought it worked really well the way they handle it in the movie.
They approach it in the
most
best possible way they could.
They make it as realistic as you possibly can make a guy training raptors,
yeah,
baby.
It's not...
So they're very unreliable, is how I would assume.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Basically, okay. You know, it's not like he snaps his fingers and the raptors does whatever he wants.
They just don't eat him.
Yeah, basically. And there's a whole thing late in the movie where he loses control of the raptors, and that's exactly what would probably happen.
And it all feels...
Does he lose control of his temper?
Yeah, and his bowels. He shits his cargo shorts.
I shit my cargo shorts in some scenes.
There are scary scenes?
Yes.
There are.
And what I do like the fact that they treat him training these raptors as authentic as possible, where they're treated as wild animals that are killing machines.
Like, yeah, the movie acknowledges that this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Like, and that's why...
Even he acknowledges that it's a bad idea, but he just happens to be good with animals. And... You know, one of the things I don't like is he sort of becomes the dinosaur...
alpha?
Yeah. Well, not... No, I like that. He becomes the dinosaur whisperer.
Oh.
And it's...
Does
it's
he ride
of,
it?
No.
There's a part at the end which is... It's so stupid, but I kind of like it where him and the raptor have a heart-to-heart, and it literally looks like the raptor goes like, meh, 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 but it really looks like the raptor is saying, get out of here. Like, it looks like the raptor is telling him to run for his safety. Because it's later revealed, spoiler, that the Indominus Rex has raptor in it, so it can do that raptor talking thing, so that dinosaur turns the raptors against him. Yeah, pretty much.
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are all the things I really, really liked about this film. And when I say I really liked it, I mean I really liked those things. That they worked on every level for me.
And they're one of the things I liked is there are some comic relief elements, not from Chris Pratt, oddly enough, but from other characters that I think work really well. Like Jake Johnson's character.
Yeah, he's funny.
He plays like a tech. He's sort of like the Nedry, I guess, of this movie, where he's like up in the control booth.
Except he's not a bad guy. Yeah, he's not a villain.
Right. And
is there a Dotson?
No Dotson here. No.
Nice hat.
Yeah. But his character works really well. And the female, I forget the actress, and she's a comedian too, but she sort of like works with him, and you can tell he has like a crush on her. And their dynamic is really well done and amusing.
I would have liked more of those two characters, honestly.
Yeah, but I would too. You know. Like, I would love if the sequel is just about them trying to find new jobs. Now that Jurassic World is like, oh, we can't get a job because Jurassic World sucked.
Okay, so those are the things I liked. Those are the things you liked.
Yeah.
Let's get into the problems that this film has.
And all right.
The big, big, big problem with this movie is every single character in it.
Oh, boy. Boy, are they clunkers.
And their dialogue is just clunky dialogue.
Right.
It's poorly written. It's poorly paced.
Nothing's earned. One of the biggest mistakes this film makes is it doesn't let Chris Pratt be funny or charming. And
he's just brooding.
Right. And funny and charming are what Chris Pratt does great. Chris Pratt, while a fun actor to watch, does not have range. He's a very one-note actor, and he's great at that one note.
Yeah, and that one note is sarcasm.
Right.
And, you know, kind of aloof.
Yeah,
you know?
But I don't fault them for trying to pull him out of that box.
I don't either, but it's too – this character is too humorless.
Yeah, he's not fun at all. It's just like what is
– Yeah.
Not only is he not fun, I don't know what his motivation is. Like why – does he care about
He's a real serious guy who likes to, you know, work at
like
his job.
I guess. But
but you know how in the first Jurassic Park, the Australian dinosaur.
Yeah. Muldoon.
Is that his name, Muldoon?
The guy who gets the clever girl guy?
He is humorless, but he's so interesting.
You know everything about him.
He's fun to watch.
He's like a badass.
Yeah,
he's badass. He's like a great white hunter.
And Chris Pratt is badass in this film as well, but he's not fun to watch. None of his scenes are fun as far as his character goes. What's happening around him is fun.
And there's
what he's saying and what he's doing and his motivations are not fun at all.
There's a few scenes where you can tell they tried to shoehorn in like the Chris Pratt humor and it doesn't work at all. It like falls flat.
And he's constantly doing Indiana Jones poses.
Yeah.
And there's one scene where he gets into an elevator and does an Indiana Jones pose for 400 minutes before the elevator doors close. It is so distracting, and I thought, what's happening right now? Why?
Right.
And everybody in the scene is looking at him as the elevator doors close, but it seems like they never close until he's finished posing.
There's that one shot of Bryce Dallas Howard with the flare in the elevator that is literally pulled from Aliens.
That works in the movie, though. In this movie, it works. I mean, between these two characters, I liked Bryce Dallas Howard's character more because
that's surprising.
Even though her character is written terribly, she at least has something to her. She's sort of this cold sort of she doesn't look at the dinosaurs as animals. She looks at them as products.
Babies. Oh.
And there's one scene where she and Chris Pratt they're out looking for the Dinosaur Rex and they find this whole field of like brontosaurus is dying. And I thought that scene worked really well because it's emotional and the music works right. And she basically – it's like the first time –
they have the flu?
Yeah. they're all under the weather. They have the chicken pox.
They have shingles.
It's like basically she watches this dinosaur die and it's like you see the character realizing, oh, these are living things. And that scene worked, but
– and a lot of people are attacking Jurassic World for – not writing women well because her character flaw is that she's not a good woman.
Yeah, her character flaw is she's a woman. That's her flaw. Like, oh, what's happening?
She's not a good woman because she's an executive and she only cares about her job and not raising children, which, you know, yes, that's ridiculous, but I'd take it even further and say that this film doesn't understand people.
No.
every person in this film is written terribly, and one-dimensional.
There's a they shoehorn this romance between her and Chris Pratt, which does not work at all.
It's totally unearned.
Like, there's this moment where they finally let Bryce Dallas Howard be, like, a badass, and, like, she shoots a pterodactyl. And they rob that scene of its impact because then Chris Pratt grabs her and starts making out with her. And it's like, if they had just done that differently where she grabs him and kisses him, that would have actually made that work, because it would have been, like, a big empowering moment. But the way it's shot, it's like her empowerment is robbed because she has to, like, no, you have to kiss the main guy.
And I will say that not once is she painted as helpless.
No.
She's never painted as helpless. She always, even though she's not in control because the park has gone beyond anybody's control at this point, but she always seems like she...
She's not an idiot.
She's not dumb.
I've seen a lot of people she's like written as like this dumb woman. She's not. She's just, you know.
She's one-dimensional.
Yeah.
Their dynamic is older brother annoyed at younger brother. We're done with that.
Those kids are, boy, do they stink. The kids in the first dress part, I won't say they're the greatest characters ever, but
they're good characters.
Again, the Tim, you know exactly what his deal is. He loves dinosaurs. And then Lex, she's a loner, and she's a hacker and all that stuff. You know everything you need to know about them with just a few lines of dialogue. In this movie, it's just like,
I don't even know what their names are.
Yeah, the older one likes Zach, the older one is likes girls, and the other one cries a lot. That's the dynamic of the kids.
And
this movie.
They're visually generic looking kids.
Very,
too.
Oh yeah, very. Yeah.
They have that same haircut.
Yep, yep. It's every character in this movie is uninteresting, and the dialogue is abysmal.
Right.
Does that fish dinosaur play any part? Or
yes,
is it just,
actually, yes. The fish dinosaur gets sort of like a big, big final moment. Yeah. Although I will say, there's a really brutal scene, which,
ooh.
I mean, I like that it's brutal because in real life, dinosaurs wouldn't discriminate, but it's so brutal that it almost takes me out of the movie, where there's a character in the film, she gets a death that's sort of as more brutal than Nedry's death. But Nedry's death is earned because he's an asshole in the first movie.
This is unearned, and it's reading characters wrong.
Right. This character, basically, she's Bryce Dallas Howard's personal assistant, and she's been watching over the kids. And basically, a pterodactyl grabs her, picks her up, fucking drops her into that big tank. Another pterodactyl dives in to grab her in the tank, and then the fish dinosaur eats her and the pterodactyl, and
it's brutal.
It's
a traumatizing death.
It's unnecessary,
and the character does not deserve it because basically all she's guilty of is being slightly negligent
and
of
not
the
even
kids.
Yeah,
and I mean slightly.
Basically,
negligent.
Yeah, she's on her phone at one point, and the kids run away from her.
Like, that's her crime. So
all they needed to do was just make her a little more hateable, and that scene would have been fine. But it's too much.
Yeah.
It's just
she's not hateable at all. She's
no.
Just, a normal,
like, you just feel
person.
Bad with her.
Is this like when Tilikum attacked his trainer?
A little bit.
Sort of, yeah.
Except this is real.
Oh.
But then, I mean, the whole ending of the movie... I slowly got that. But, I mean, the ending, it has a great sort of moment for the T-Rex. I loved that. I feel like even though it's fan service, it works.
Yeah, that's the other thing I'm not sure that I love is the fan service, the amount of fan service. Because, like I said, that scene where the kids find the old visitor center, I like that.
But it's just a little
definitely,
too much.
That could be considered pandering.
Is it like a guy shaving with the Barbasol? Like,
we're just shy of that happening.
That said, there are moments of fan service that work really well. Like when they first get to the park, they're in the new visitor center, and you just see in the background on one of the display screens, you see a kid watching the Mr. DNA video. And I really like that because they don't like shove it in your face. It's just, you just notice it.
Is there a statue of what's his name?
John Hammond. Yes, there is a statue of John Hammond.
And I mean, people will criticize the film for, you know, being heavy on product placement. There's Mercedes all over the place. Bryce Dallas Howard, when she makes that joke about the Verizon Wireless presents Indominus Rex, all the while she's holding a Starbucks cup. It's all over the place.
Yeah, that's rough.
But, you know, I like this movie a lot.
In the end, I walked out of this film, I won't say I walked out loving it, but I had a really good time.
I
didn't walk out thinking, like, boy, what a mistake. Like, you know, it's not overly long. It's, you know, it's
a tight 2 hours and 7 minutes, yeah. just like the first one.
It runs. It never slows down. The action is great. I mean, if you're looking for a dumb summer movie that's fun,
yeah,
that's this movie.
Yeah.
I feel like the mistake people are making is they keep comparing it to Jurassic Park. And honestly, you're never – that movie's like lightning in a bottle. You're never going to –
magic. And this has elements of magic. The action – I think all the action and all the special effects, I got that magic feeling.
Yeah.
But it's weighed down by the abysmal characters, character development, dialogue. So you got to take that with a grain of salt.
Right.
If you're looking for character – rich characters – don't go see this movie.
No,
if you're
absolutely
for,
not.
Like you said, a dumb summer movie. This is you can't go wrong with Jurassic yeah. World.
This is a better cool. Godzilla movie than last year's Godzilla.
Yes. And and the monsters aren't so heavy around the midsection.
They're on the Atkins diet, I believe.
So, what do you call a blind dinosaur?
I don't know.
Please tell us.
Okay, let's go to break.
That was very unsatisfying.
I want to know the answer.
So that's all you got on Jurassic
Yeah, go
Park-y
see
World.
It. You've probably already seen it because it's made a bajillion dollars. And we're going to go to break. We're going to come back.
Oh, the idea of what the next sequels were. So what do you think they could do next?
I have no idea. The only thing I can think of is the next sequel is
Bryce Dallas Howard goes to jail.
Or, yeah, she's in court tied up in litigation because...
Forever.
Yeah, because basically the film lets her off really easily at the end where she's just like, all right, we're really... She's at least partially responsible for this, so...
She's like Big Tobacco and The Insider.
Yeah, and that's a nice segue because when we come back from break, we'll be talking about Michael Mann's The Insider. Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do. It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons.
All right, turn this off before we get sued.
Oh, I thought we were going to play the whole song.
Theory. Oh, I guess that's you.
Okay, so
we're back.
Yes, and we
have a dinosaur story.
We have a new sponsor, Audible.
Jurassic Park.
Oh, no, I wish. They've got the big bucks.
So if you go to audibletrial.com/cutprintfilm, you can sign up and get a free audiobook. And this week, the book of the week, well, actually, the book of the bye week,
yes,
is Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton, and it's narrated by Scott Brick.
Ooh.
And it's a 15-hour audio book.
And it sounds funny.
I mean, you don't have to listen for all 15 hours at once. I mean, you can space it out.
You can start anywhere in the book that you please. But yeah, this is it retails for $13.99, but you can get it for free if you use our promo code, is audibletrial.com/cutprintfilm.
That's right. Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial if you just sign up for this via this deal.
I mean, and yeah, we get kickbacks here.
I mean, yeah, if you've ever said,
ouch,
I want to give those boys on that show some money, but I can't afford it. Well, this is free. You just sign up.
Not only do you get this podcast, you also get a free audiobook.
I mean, come on. Can you beat that, America?
No, you can't. You really can't.
And knowledge. And you know what they say about knowledge?
No.
It's power.
Oh.
Oh, all right. Thanks for that.
Like, audiobooks, they're great. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have no time to read anymore. But audiobooks, you can put them on in your car, sit in the garage with the engine running, and
yes,
just listen. It's a good time.
Your wife comes out, wonders what's going on. Nothing, honey. Go back inside. I'm listening to Jurassic Park.
I'm just listening to some Audible audiobooks.
audibletrial.com/cupprintfilm.
That's right.
And that's not a trial like a court case, in case you are aware.
No, this is a good trial.
There's no litigation involved.
No paternity suits.
That's right. And there's also no obligation. It's free. You can sign up. You can cancel anytime. You're not going to get locked into some goofball contract.
You might get locked into my sex dungeon.
Well.
Where I'll put you on the sex swing and push you and we'll have a good time.
That's listening to audiobooks.
You might get hooked on books, though, and you just can't stop.
Yeah. And that's a different problem. You need to call someone for that.
Okay, so that's done with.
Yes.
That's out of the way.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to move on to the finale of our Michael Mann director series, where we'll be talking about The Insider.
Holy cow.
Starring Russell Crowe and Al Pacino.
That's right.
And Christopher Plummer.
Oh, yeah, he's great in this.
So before we go any further and get ahead of ourselves, let me play this.
It's the Cut Print Film Director Series.
Action!
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
That's right. The Director Series, for those who don't know, and really, you really should by now, it's where we pick a director, we pick three films by that director, and then we talk about those films over a period of three shows.
Yeah. And I typically read the plot synopsis, and I usually grab it from various sources, usually using Wikipedia as my main source. However, this plot is so involved, it would take a half hour to just read the synopsis. So this is going to be a very abridged version, a bridge to nowhere.
Oh, yes.
So The Insider tells the true story of a man who decided to tell the world what the quote-unquote seven dwarves of the tobacco industry, and those are the seven major tobacco companies,
Smokey and Pipey. And
yes.
Yes.
Smokey and Pipey.
That's it.
He decides to tell the world what the seven major tobacco companies knew and concealed about the dangers of their product. Jeffrey Wigand, played by Russell Crowe, was a scientist employed in research for a tobacco firm, Brown and Williamson. Now, is that a fictional?
No, it's real.
Okay, that is real. Okay. And not long after he was fired by Brown and Williamson, Wigand came into contact with Lowell Bergman, played by Al Pacino, a producer for 60 Minutes, who worked closely with journalist Mike Wallace, played here by Christopher Plummer.
Who's really good in this.
Excellent. Man, I bought that he was Mike Wallace.
It's great.
Big time.
It's not like an impression. It's just a great performance.
Yeah. Bergman arranged for Wigand to be interviewed by Wallace for a 60 Minutes expose on the cigarette industry, and though Wigand was still bound by a confidentiality agreement not to discuss his employment with the company. Despite Wigand's willingness to talk, CBS pulled the interview from airing at the last minute after Brown and Williamson threatened a multi-billion dollar lawsuit because they had a pretty much an endless supply of money to throw at any lawsuit that they choose to instigate.
That's the big theme of the film, is that big tobacco, they're unbeatable just because they have so much money, they'll just tie you up in litigation forever. Yeah.
Yeah. And the staff of 60 Minutes and CBS News are soon embroiled in an internal struggle over the killing of the story, and Wigand found himself the subject of lawsuits and a smear campaign from Brown and Williamson and the entire tobacco industry without his full story ever reaching the public.
Right.
And that's it. That's essentially a, you know, summarized version of the film.
Right.
This movie is much more about It's a character study, and it's a procedural, and it's much more than just the plot.
It's the inverse of All the President's Men, whereas All the President's Men, it's a film about investigative journalism where the journalists are heroes. In this film, the journalists, they basically...
They're conflicted.
Yeah, they buckle, really. The only one who sticks to his guns is Al Pacino's character. Everyone else is just like, all right, we'll kill the story for money.
And they're complicit in pretty much ruining a man's life.
Right.
And yeah.
It's a cynical look at journalism, basically. Where, and not even just journalism, but like telejournalism, which is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. So, again, this is director Michael Mann. And this,
I would say this is probably my tied for favorite Michael Mann movie with Heat.
This is so good.
It's a great movie.
This is we were all talking about this before the microphones were turned on, but... This type of movie is the type of movie that we can all like sink our teeth into, and I never tire of this kind of movie.
Right.
Where it's investigative journalism. There's some sort of investigation going on. It's adults talking to each other like adults talk to one another.
There's just something about just journalism movies that are done well that just really get to me. Like this movie or Zodiac, All the President's Men, just movies like that. I just love that.
Yeah.
Just,
Well, this is two genres, really, because it's like the investigative thriller, but it's also like a corporate thriller.
Yeah. Which,
and those are two genres that are awesome. Like, and you don't get enough of these kinds of movies.
And if done wrong, they can be terrible.
Oh my goodness, just
terribly boring and dull.
Boring, dull, and stupid.
And this movie is literally, it's people in rooms talking. That's it. But yeah, it's so compelling, and just the action is just in the performances and just the material, and it just, it works so well.
And I say this with love in my heart, next to nothing happens in this movie.
No.
Almost nothing actually happens.
I mean, I didn't even think about
you're
that.
You're just seeing people reacting to things happening.
There are a few scenes that something sort of happens, and even then they don't. Like, there's a great scene, Russell Crowe, he's out at the driving range golfing, and he's really paranoid because he thinks it's him alone, and then way down at the other end there's a guy in a suit also golfing, and the guy is watching him. And really, nothing happens in this scene. They're just golfing, but it's so tense, and it's shot gorgeously with this sort of blue night filter over it. And it's almost like chilling just the way Michael Mann frames this, because literally, even though nothing happens, you get this sense of danger that, oh, something's going
to
happen.
Yeah, and he doesn't even like get to beat the guy's car with his golf
club. No, the guy just drives away, and you never even find out if that guy really is spying on him.
And like, something almost happens, but it doesn't. And there's a lot of that. There's a scene where there's death threats on the Wygant's computer.
With that great old school fake email where it flies in and takes up the whole page.
What does it say? I'll fucking kill you.
Yes, in huge font.
And as subtle as that is, it works because it implies danger without danger ever happening. There's a scene where Jeffrey Wygant's daughter says she just saw somebody outside, and he goes and gets a gun. And he goes looking for somebody, never finds anybody, but he sees footprints that may or may not have been somebody in the yard.
And he comes home one day and he finds like a bullet just inside his mailbox. And just, it's stuff like that where we don't ever find out who's doing this. And in real life, the real Jeffrey Wygant's wife, she divorced him, and she said she actually thinks he put that bullet in the mailbox himself as just sort of a...
That's what I wanted to talk about. And they don't...
Well, they kind of imply that in the movie.
Yeah. A little bit. But the way Russell Crowe's character, Jeffrey Wygant, reacts to that, you get the sense that he absolutely did not put that in there. But
that's one of the most upsetting scenes of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
When they take his computer and you realize that those FBI agents aren't there to help him. Yeah. It's like, makes you feel so powerless.
One of the things I love that this movie did is, even though Russell Crowe's character, Jeffrey Wygant, he's doing a noble thing, it does a great job portraying that he's actually kind of an asshole.
Well, he's complicit in tobacco. Like, he worked for tobacco companies, and he didn't do anything to fight them until he was fired.
Right. It's just like, basically, the only reason he's doing this is like sort of like petty revenge and just his general personality in general. Like, I read a lot of interviews with the real old Bergman, and even like, as they were researching this movie, the screenwriter and Michael Mann, they went to meet with the real Jeffrey Wygant, and the screenwriter, what's his name? Eric Roth. He said that the real Jeffrey Wygant just struck him as really just unsympathetic. And I really like that. That comes through in the movie. I mean, he's a little more sympathetic than I'm sure he was in real life in this movie.
Yeah.
But I like that they kept that this character, he's just abrasive.
He's a scientist. He's cold. He's clinical.
Yeah, and they even say, like, they mention a few times that he's kind of not on the same social plane as everyone else. He doesn't pick up on cues and stuff, so that explains a little bit of it.
Right, and I got that from Russell Crowe's portrayal. I got that, like, detached humanity.
Like the Zuckerberg
A little bit
complex.
Like that, Like,
and Russell Crowe, fucking so good in this.
He is. He's excellent. I didn't buy that he was a scientist.
Yeah.
Only because the screenplay didn't really sell that to me. And I can't really fault it because that's not really what this film is about.
He seemed more like an executive than a scientist.
Yes, he did.
There's something like in the early scenes before you realize who the character is, Russell Crowe's performance feels weird. And you kind of have to get used to
happening. I bought it. It just, I mean, there are scenes, like there's that scene where he's flipping through the documents that Al Pacino gives him. That makes him seem like a scientist. But overall,
He honestly seems like an executive, right, like a corporate executive.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, there's something off about his whole performance efforts. Like, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but a lot of the stuff with him and his family, it felt weird.
It felt weird, but I feel like it's realistic in the sense of the way this character is, in that I feel like this is how this guy would act with a family, where He just doesn't really know how to be a family man.
Yeah, one of the problems I have with the family scenes is that his wife didn't seem to be a family woman either.
No.
They were so detached from – and his wife was played by Diane Venora.
Yes.
And I don't love her performance.
I don't know if it's so much the performance as it's the character.
Yeah, I can't decide whether it's the character I dislike or if it's the performance.
Like, very cold character. Like, she finds out he gets fired. The only thing she cares about is
the size of the house.
Yeah,
their
bills and stuff.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's a realistic worry, but she doesn't stop for a second to wonder, you know, how he's reacted to being fired. She's just like, what about our, you know, house payments?
Yeah. So you get it's just these two cold people.
Right.
And so you're never really fully invested in the tragedy of Jeffrey Wigand's downfall because he's just so cold as a person. So the real interesting character in this film is Lowell Bergman,
yes.
Played by Al Pacino.
And Al Pacino... I love how restrained Al Pacino is.
He's not screaming and yelling. It's just one. It's like it's classic Al Pacino.
Al Pacino has
classic Al.
He's sort of become a parody of himself, where everyone remembers him just for, you know, oh, he yells a lot and he does. But in this movie, he's very he's acting, and it's a really. I bought that this. I didn't not once did I watch this and think, oh, that's Al Pacino. I bought that this was a new, like a journalist. Yes. I bought that 100%. It really worked.
Yeah,
for me.
I'll agree with that. And at first I was like, I could use a different actor in this role. But as the movie went on, you forget he's Al Pacino.
Right. And you totally buy that this is a guy who's really invested in protecting his sources and getting the story. And he's you know, he's cavalier about it, but he's not coldly. So like he wants that story and he's going to do what he has to do to get it. But he also doesn't want to burn people. And other characters in the film, they clearly don't care about that at all.
What another thing this film does so well is that it paints the media as somewhat nefarious.
Oh, yeah.
And only interested in the story rather than the people involved in the story.
Absolutely.
So where we were talking about the bullet maybe possibly being put in the mailbox by Jeffrey Wigand, I was also thinking – did Lowell Bergman maybe put that in there to kind of force Wigand's hand?
Because in the scene before that, he's talking to the Mississippi Attorney General I don't know who that guy is, if he's the Attorney General or not.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
District Attorney, I think.
Okay, yeah. And they're saying, like, oh, he's on the fence. Like, he might not talk about it.
And
That's interesting. I didn't even think of that.
And it immediately puts him over the edge.
Yeah.
Right, and that's solid writing and that solid direction by Mann to like, put those scenes back to back. And you get this – you never find out who put the bullet in the mailbox. No. You never find out who put that message on their computer through the email or if that even existed.
Yeah,
and it is interesting that your theory that Al Pacino's character put the bullet in the mailbox because simultaneously he's working on a story about the Unabomber.
Right.
And so it like fits like the train of thought.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that tie together really, really nicely. And again, you have to hand that to Michael Mann because this is Michael Mann firing on all cylinders.
Let's talk about just the direction in general.
It's unbelievable.
Man, is it cool. Just
you mentioned Zodiac. It really reminded me of Zodiac. Yeah. It's again, Michael Mann likes to do things very cold, very precise,
right.
And it works. It totally works.
This is Michael Mann before he entered his quote-unquote bullshit digital phase when Public Enemies, where everything looks just like a camcorder shooting it. Like, this film just looks gorgeous.
Yeah.
I will say, at times, this felt a little too Michael Mann-y.
Really?
For the tone of the movie, you know what I mean? Like, the opening itself, how it opens with that blindfold, and it's, like, in Hezbollah, Iran, and you're like... what the hell's going on here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That just, and it's like, it's doing that thing where it's like shooting from so many different angles of him driving.
I mean, yeah, that opening, it's shot like a heist is about to happen.
I did not like that opening, but
I liked the interview it led into.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And that gives us basically where we're going with this. He's trying at all costs to get these interviews from Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. And it's again, like you get the feeling that a heist is going to happen. But nothing happens.
Right.
The payoff is an interview.
Mm-hmm.
That's the action, is an interview.
I feel like if they had just opened with the interview, it would probably be just a little bit. At the same time, though, I love how that quick opening is shot where the guy he's talking to just like leaves the room and he just like mysteriously, like I like that. I mean,
and that again, that's Michael Mann.
Right.
He likes playing tricks like that.
And yeah, and it feels like a commentary on his own movies. Like
right.
It's like the antithesis of Heat, where there's so much
that's true,
shit
like,
happening.
Even though this looks like a Michael Mann movie, it's not your typical Michael Mann subject matter, really. It's, you know,
this is very visually similar to Heat.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And it's not just Al Pacino, but like the shots in this movie.
Oh yeah, I think that's just the signature Mann style.
I don't know, because like Last of the Mohicans.
Well, I feel like it's the signature style that he eventually adopted, because Heat looks like this. This looks like Collateral. They all sort of
have a Black Hat, and I'm seriously asking: does Black Hat look similar to this style of filmmaking?
Black Hat, as narratively terrible as it is, and it does have that shitty digital look. There are some shots in Black Hat which are friggin' gorgeous that just look incredible, and the action in Black Hat is shot in this really uptight sort of. You're just right in the action. And I mean, Black Hat, even though I hated the movie, it looks like a Michael Mann movie.
Yeah.
I wasn't.
That's always a good thing.
Right.
That's a compliment.
Right.
To have something look like a Michael Mann movie. There's a really gorgeous, if not silly, scene where Al Pacino is on his cell phone in the ocean.
That's probably my favorite Michael Mann shot of all time, because it pulls back to this extreme wide shot where the sky is just this dark, ominous just color, and Al Pacino's just in the ocean on his phone for no reason.
Yes.
Yeah, he's having trouble hearing, so he walks out
into the ocean.
All this water should help with the reception.
And it's silly, but it looks gorgeous. Like,
it's
like,
beautiful.
It just like takes my breath away, that wide shot. Just, I love it.
There's a great scene where Russell Crowe's washing his hands, and then it's shot from the outside of the house, and
yes.
You see the security guard sitting under the window.
Right, and he gets in a fight with his wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like an awesome shot of the dark, like the light inside the house and the darkness outside with this guy just keeping watch over.
It's like an Edward Hopper painting almost.
Yeah.
And I love that. And
this movie, it just looks incredible. And it was nominated for so many Academy Awards,
right.
And it was completely shut out. It was up for Best Picture. It was up for Best Actor for Russell Crowe, Best Director for Michael Mann, Screenplay,
and
Cinematography.
And I'm shocked that Christopher Plummer did not get like a Best Supporting Actor nomination or even win for this, because he's that good.
He is.
What won
excellent.
In 99?
I feel like – I'm not sure, but I feel like every performance in this – is just top notch. It's great. It's a really good. There's a great scene with Bruce McGill. He plays the one lawyer in that scene, and the big tobacco guy lawyer is like,
oh, okay.
He's like, oh, Dr. Wigand, I urge you not to talk. And just Bruce McGill's character just shuts him down. He's just like, wipe that smirk off your face. And that's in any other film, that character would just be like this throwaway lawyer, but it's so memorable just from that guy's performance. It's great.
I'm a big fan of his work.
Yeah.
What's the guy's name who plays like Mike Wallace's boss?
Philip Baker Hall,
yeah.
Who's in a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson movies.
You'd be surprised to learn is not Stacy Keach.
I kept wanting to say John Voight. I'm like, that's not John Voight.
It's Jimmy Gator from Magnolia.
Yeah.
Yes. He's great. Everyone's great in this movie. And but yeah, Christopher Plummer is really good.
He is incredible. He's you get the sense that he's conflicted. He's as conflicted as Lowell Bergman is.
Right. There's a great because even though Mike Wallace's character, he originally sides with the company, he has a sort of redemption moment. First, he comes to Lowell Bergman's hotel room, and they have this sort of heart-to-heart where Mike Wallace is like, you know, when you get to my you're reaching the end of your career, you don't want to be remembered for the things you did wrong. And he doesn't want to – he feels like if he backed this story and it cost the network, you know, they wouldn't exist anymore, that's what he'd be remembered for. And that sort of makes sense. Even though it's not journalistic integrity, it also makes sense that you want a legacy. I mean –
yeah, and at first I wasn't buying that motivation, but the more I thought about it, like as the scene goes on, you're almost in Al Pacino's like footsteps there, where you
want to shut him down. You're just like, shut up! I don't want to hear it.
It starts making sense.
Yeah,
you're like, oh fuck.
And then he has that great moment at the end where he's like, you know, fame lasts for 15 minutes, but infamy lasts a lot longer. And I really like that line, just the way he delivers it. Yeah.
Just to tie things up with the Academy Awards shutout.
The Insider was beat in every category by American Beauty.
Oh, my.
including Best Picture and Best Director.
Who won Best Alan Supporting Ball. Actor that year, does it say?
Best Supporting Actor.
Was it me?
Yes, it was. Best Supporting Actor was Michael Caine for The Cider House Rules.
I mean, I like Michael Caine, but Christopher Plummer is so good in this. But then Christopher Plummer eventually won for that Adult Beginners movie. So I guess that was sort of like the compensation for his entire career.
But yeah, every category that this was nominated in, it was beat by a representative of American Beauty.
Well, then.
So that's the... The 72nd Academy Awards recap for you.
The 90s, everyone.
The Insider kind of made me wish Michael Mann had like a TV show like The Newsroom to tackle. Like, I wanted to kind of like live in this movie a little more.
Yeah, just a movie just set in this like the high speed telejournalism world. That would be cool.
Yeah, that's the thing. This is a 2.5 hour movie. And not once did I look at my phone to see what time it was. I was completely engaged the entire time. Yeah.
It's long, but I personally never feel like – this is one of those movies that I said this before, but like, you know, movies like Zodiac where if this were like, you know, 7 hours, I would be like, I'm watching all 7 hours of this because I want more.
Yeah, it's compelling dialogue. It's just great, great writing, wonderful performances. And again, Michael Mann's direction. This is Michael Mann at the top of his game. I mean – you can argue Heat is Michael Mann at the top of his game, but I'd say this is a close second.
And the one thing I love about this movie the most is how adult it is. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like you would not be able to get this movie.
A lot of naked people in it.
Yeah, there's tons of it. There's
lots of nudity and sexual situations.
I know, it's so adult. And but I feel like you could never get this movie greenlit now with this plot and this, you know, and these actors. Like, they'd be like,
you'd get it greenlit, but it would be a low budget independent film with unknown.
I mean, like a movie
television.
I mean, like a movie on this level where it's a big production with big star. You would never get that off the ground now because they'd be like, oh, you need more, you know, gunfights in it. You need younger characters. It needs to be set at Gawker, perhaps, instead of 60 minutes.
Yeah.
It would have to be somebody like Michael Mann now who can get away with making.
But even
he wants.
Like, I'd argue, like, Black Hat, I refuse to believe he was like, oh, I want to cast Chris Hemsworth as this world renowned. I'm sure that was like a studio who was like, we'll greenlight your stupid hacker movie.
Have you seen this guy's abs?
Yeah.
He's got to be the hacker.
Exactly. Like, I feel like even Michael Mann can't do this anymore.
No, I'm saying, like, he was doing this on the heels of Heat when he had the Heat.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Nice. Nice one.
It also comes on the heels of Devil's Advocate with Al Pacino.
At his most Al Pacino-ness.
Yes, he's Pacinoing it up.
Ah! I'm the devil, he says.
But yeah, like, and that's the thing.
Ah, hell! Yeah! Look out!
That Michael Mann was able to reel Pacino in because it was a 1-2 punch of Scent of a Woman and then Devil's Advocate where he's literally just yelling for 2 hours.
Michael Mann said, Pacino, we're gonna Pacino yes this film.
So yeah, this is an incredible movie. I really liked it. Again, nothing actually happens in it, but if you happen to like dialogue-driven films and character studies, you got to watch this movie. You have to.
I mean, I can't think of any reason why you wouldn't want to like this, unless you're like a fucking dullard.
A fuddy-duddy.
Yes, unless you're Archie's friend Jughead, and this isn't the film for you.
Is this on Blu-ray, do you know?
I don't know.
Is it just strictly, because, I mean...
I watched it on the DVD I had, it's so old, it had an ad for The Sixth Sense on it.
That is old.
So...
was he still dead at the end?
Yes!
Don't spoil it.
At the end, he tries the door, but there's a table in front of it.
Don't spoil that for our listeners. They might not have seen The Sixth Sense.
The Insider is on Blu-ray, so pick it up.
Yeah, definitely watch this. It's visually appealing. There's some great acting, and obviously the writing and direction is incredible.
That's right. So I guess this concludes our Michael Mann series. So what do you guys think of Michael Mann in general?
Michael Mann, we hardly knew ye.
Yes. We dearly beloved, we are gathered today to marry Michael Mann to the director series. Yes.
I think this is another illuminating director series that gives you a different perspective on how another auteur affected the landscape of movies.
Yeah, I liked that the films we picked were all thematically different. I mean, you know, there's I can't think of three movies that are more unalike, where Thief, The Last Mohicans, and The Insider, but they're all from the same director, which is kind of insane.
You have the crime story, the epic love adventure story, and then this cold investigative journalism based on a true story.
Right.
Yeah, the closest director series we did that reminds me of this is the Stanley Kubrick one, which was The Killing, Barry Lyndon, and Eyes Wide Shut, where it's like you see we got that evolution in this director series that we got in that one.
Yeah, and that always makes for a more, you know, satisfying viewing experience as far as I'm concerned.
So you at home, we want to know what you thought of this director series, so why don't you email us at info@cutprintfilm.com. Let us know what you thought.
And info@cutprintfilm.com.
Oh,
Sorry. Don't you dare forget the .com. You'll get an email from the mailer demon.
I'm the mailer demon! Hoo-ah! And so I guess at this point, it's time to announce our next director.
You're going
to
announce your retirement.
I'm going to announce I have nothing more to do. Our next director is going to be a controversial pick if you're a snob.
Yes, it's Adolf Hitler.
Yes, he made some great films. This director, he's often thought of as a blockbuster mainstream sort of guy. But with this next director series, we're trying to prove that he's more than that. He's a master at what he does. And his name is Roberto Benigni. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Yes, we'll be starting with his Pinocchio.
I had the wrong ad copy in front of me. It's actually Steven Spielberg.
Oh, I'm excited.
That's right. And we're going to start with his film E.T. will be our first Spielberg film.
Yes. I love the work of E.T. Right. I like all the sequels.
Yes.
The E.T. cinematic universe.
I love Entertainment Tonight, which was a spinoff of E.T.
God, you're right. There's a movie where it came out, it made a ton of money, and they just left it there.
Well, they thought about making a sequel, actually, but they never got off the ground.
There's a sequel book.
There's like a script written for
E2?
It. Yeah.
Well, on that note,
it's called E2 Brute. I'm not sure when that episode is going to air, because we're going to be delayed just a little bit longer because Dave is going somewhere mysterious. I believe Croatia.
He's going to the Iron Isles.
Yeah, he's going to Fire Island. And but we'll be back sooner or later with E.T. as our first Steven Spielberg director series.
I'm excited for the Steven Spielberg director series.
Right. I'm also excited for the Steven Spielberg director series.
Tune in, folks.
I'm excited for the Steven Singer director series.
Oh, hate StevenSinger.com. Get your tacky gold-dipped rose and throw it in the garbage.
The other corner of 8th and Walnut.
That's it. We're going to recommend some movies now.
Do it.
That's not short enough.
Well, I had a nervous breakdown.
The film podcast would be so much better.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
I need some harmonies, boys. Come on.
Nope. I'm not playing
along.
What
about eHarmony.com?
There we go. None of these are sponsored.
We're just free. We're just giving them away.
Our sponsor, in case you forgot, is audibletrial.com/cutprintfilm. Get your free audiobook.
Please
get your
do
beach
it.
Books for the summer.
Yeah. I'll go first.
Okay.
All right, so, in keeping with the whole journalism sort of aspect and also the Russell Crowe aspect, my pick is 2009's State of Play.
Ooh.
So this is I feel like this film, no one really saw it. It sort of came out and just faded. And it's not a fantastic movie, but it's a really interesting movie. It has that same sort of journalism aspect to it. Russell Crowe plays a journalist. He works for the Washington Post, I believe. And this story breaks about this woman throws herself in front of a train, and we find out this woman, who was an aide to a congressman played by Ben Affleck, was also his mistress. And all this sort of stuff starts to unfold involving like this army group that's sort of like that I forget what they're called, but they're like mercenaries who just work for the government, but they're not actually army. And there's all these conspiracies and all this stuff just built into it. I don't know. It's a really it's a compelling movie. It's not fantastic. I mean, it's nothing you haven't seen before.
Yeah.
But it moves at a really nice pace. Russell Crowe is really good in it. And it's sort of it came out in 2009, so it's sort of at the cusp of when like print journalism was dying and blogging was taking over. So Rachel McAdams is in this film, and she plays the newspaper's blogging journalist, like the blogger, and her and Russell Crowe are constantly butting heads about, you know, old school and new journalism.
How so is
like,
she in this?
She's good.
I'm not the biggest Rachel McAdams fan.
I'm not either, but she's playing a character who's clearly supposed to be much younger than she really is. But, I mean, it works in the film.
12.
Yeah, she's supposed to be 10 years old.
That's unrealistic.
But, this sounds like the early episodes of House of Cards.
It is, actually. It's a lot like that. It's like a film version of that. I mean, it's got a good cast. I mean, Russell Crowe is in it. Ben Affleck, who I like Ben Affleck in general. He's in it. Rachel McAdams.
Helen Mirren.
And Robin Wright, who is on House of Cards, is also in this film.
All right, so it's a really good cast.
Yeah,
then.
So yeah, I recommend it. It is State of Play from
2009.
All right. I really wish they had just had him in Jurassic World. At one point.
I'm here! He, like, busts out of the...
He busts out of the Adamus Rex's corpse. I was in there the entire time!
Oh, now I know it
dies.
Toasty
in there. All right, who's going next?
I'll go.
All right, good.
You want to go? No, I'm just kidding. I'm going to recommend a movie that you can't see yet.
God,
as usual. Pixar's Inside Out, which comes out June 19th in theaters. Disney, Pixar, go see it.
Is that this Wednesday?
Yes.
All right.
I think. No.
So, yeah.
Is it?
It's either Wednesday or Friday. But, yeah, so Pixar, in my mind at least, have sort of been on a downswing lately, but I hear this is fantastic.
Yes, this movie is absurdly original, and that's what I liked about it.
It's a lot like Cars 2.
Is this another plane sequel?
Yeah, is Dane Cook in it as the biplane?
So you're going to get mad at me for saying this, Chris, but this is another movie that I went into, like, wanting to hate.
Oh, I assume that now for every movie you go to.
And that's the best way to approach a film.
Dave sits down, he puts on his wedding video, and he's just like, I'm going to fucking hate this.
But, like, as it was starting, I was like, this is stupid. Like, in a baby's brain, I get it. I see where this is going. And then it just, like, it blossomed. Like, and the movie literally blossoms because it... It starts with nothing, like a baby's brain, just goo and cells.
And delicious. Oh, I'm sorry.
But like,
the Parmesan cheese, Dave.
Like, as she grows up and gets smarter, like the world inside
expands.
The brain grows, and
oh, that's
like,
cool.
It's just so cool. There's so many layers to it.
I will say that reaction is how I sat down when I watched Frozen, where it started and I was just like, this is stupid. And then like 10 minutes in, I was like, I'm enchanted by Frozen. I love this movie.
This movie is not as emotional as Up, but like for some, and I can't understand why, because I was like choking up at the littlest things in this. So I knew that they were doing something right.
Well,
the
theme is just sort of emotion in general, isn't it? So, I mean, is that it? That it's just a movie about emotion?
I didn't even think of that. But that's pretty smart, Chris. I'm going to use that in my review. But it's a lot to do with like family, and like it taps into a kind of nostalgia you have of like being a kid growing up and dealing with the whole plot of the movie is that joy like isn't the best thing all the time.
Oh, that's...
And like sadness can actually kind of help you in situations. And
that's kind of subversive for a kid's movie.
And
I
it's
like
such
that.
An important lesson for kids to learn, because kid culture is like, be happy. Be happy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Everything is awesome.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this kind of takes that and spins it on its head, and it does it in such a brilliantly original way that everyone has to see.
I got to say, this is probably the first Pixar movie since Up that I'm excited to see now.
I'm with you. Yeah. I haven't been interested in a Pixar film since Up.
Yeah.
And
if you guys hate it, just never come back for the podcast.
All right. Sounds fair.
I might not do that even if I like it.
I never get tired of that.
Okay, my pick is a film that came out last week. It's a horror film. It's called We Are Still Here.
Nice.
And Chris, you gave it a good review on cutprintfilm.com. And so I thought, well, me and Chris have similar horror tastes, so let me watch this.
Similarly horrible taste, is that
no,
what you meant to
Dave,
say?
Good one.
Don't insult the two of us.
We also have similar taste in jeans.
Yes. We
bright
like black
pink.
Jeans. They're
oh.
delicious. So, this is a movie, it's a haunted house film, and it's a great throwback film to 70s horror and even 80s horror.
It's a lot like Euro horror, like a Fulci film.
Yeah.
Like, it reminded me a lot of, there's a film called The House by the Cemetery, and it's the tone matches that movie.
Yeah,
It's so odd the way this film unfolds. You think you're getting one thing, but you get something completely different in the end.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give away too much, but basically this takes place after the death of this couple's son. They buy this house in this town, and weird things start happening in the house, and the wife thinks that it's their son trying to contact them, and the locals are behaving strangely, and they're given a warning about the house, that it was originally owned by a guy that...
like a funeral home.
It was a funeral home, and...
Oh, fuck that.
Yeah.
And, hey, that's my dream house. I'm not even kidding. I would buy a funeral home.
And the guy was selling the bodies to universities, and so he was run out of town, and... So the house has this inherent evil to it, and it just grows and grows, and the film changes as it goes. It becomes things that you weren't expecting, all horror-related. It's a true horror film, but there's gore for gore hounds, and...
Yeah, there's something, just like a little bit of everything for horror fans.
And I'm a big fan of haunted house movies. I love a good haunted house
story. Sounds kind of like Cabin in the Woods.
Similar.
It's
not as goofy.
And it's not as meta as that, but... Yeah, what I liked about it is that it's fun. It's a horror movie that has fun. I feel like,
but not too much. It's not having too much.
Yeah, it's
fun.
Not like cheeky. Like it's not a comedy. But I feel like most horror movies today, especially in the Blumhouse variety, they have no room for fun. It's all just like look at this
terror.
Look at how serious all this is. And this film,
here comes Childish Gambino in a pig mask.
Yeah, look out. And this film, there aren't any jump scares. It's just, it's creepy. It builds an atmosphere, and that goes a long way in horror, especially for low budget horror, because you can tell the budget on this was not. It's like, it's all in one set, basically.
Yeah,
so.
But it works. Everything about this works, and I really recommend it. It's called We Are Still Here. And you can watch it now. I think it's streaming
it's on
iTunes.
Everywhere. Anywhere video on demand is, you can get Amazon. I think even on like Xfinity and Verizon, you can stream it.
All right.
Well,
that's that, folks. We're done.
Yes.
We're all retiring to the Cayman Islands.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yes.
But in real life, we're not.
No, we'll still be plugging away at this horse shit. Day after day.
And you can get all the horse shit and more at cutprintfilm.com.
Yes, we're positively swimming with shit. We have
good shit.
We have reviews coming up this week for Dave.
Inside Out.
Yes. Yeah. Isn't that going to be lovely?
And In-N-Out starring Kevin Kline.
And In-N-Out Burger. I'll have it monster style.
It's animal style.
Get it right. Sorry, I don't eat garbage.
I do.
And as always, we encourage you to go to iTunes and give this podcast a 5-star rating. It really helps us out.
It truly does. And you can check out our friends, antifanboy.com. They do a podcast about video games, comic books.
Clams, anticlamboy.com.
I don't know why we keep going back to that well. It's certainly dry.
A lot of shucking going on.
And you can also check out joystickjerks.com. The Joystick Jerks podcast is a video game podcast. Very funny.
They'll teach you how to play video games, so go check it out.
Every video game ever made.
None of this is true.
Right. And check us out on Twitter, at Cutprint Film. Go to Facebook, like us. Just like us. Please, we just want to be liked.
Yeah, we demand love, and we'll force you by gun.
Yeah, I mean, what choice do you have?
Love me.